Good evening and welcome to the October 12th edition of Kaecheung Radio's The Talking Show. My name's Steve Cato, and with me as ever is my indefatigable co-host, Nicholas Miller.
Hey, Steve. Great to be indefatigable here with you.
Well, we did see some people get like a little bit fatigued, I would say, earlier today. Yeah. We were just over at the disgraced Marciano collection, the punished...
The building formerly known as...
Marciano Foundation, yeah. Now a rental to Larry the Gagosian.
Yeah, lobby rental and then like children's den upstairs.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
I like calling him the Gagosian, like he's a character in Star Wars, like the Mandalorian or something like that.
Right.
Well, this is, you know, like, if you want to see those are in the hands of the Gagosian. You're like, oh, we must go to the Gagosian now to see that.
Well, because there's a part of me when you see those sorts of representations in film where you're like, well, everyone around him seems to hate him. Why do they obey him? Just because he has an absurd amount of resources and cash? That's preposterous. And then I realize, wait, that's actually exactly how it works.
Yeah.
That's pretty much how all power in our time works.
But, you know, sometimes the drippings fall out of the roasting pan of power, and we can sup upon their succulent nectar. We just went to a wonderful Eliane Radig concert, heard some lovely music, which we won't talk about too much because this is the talking show and we have a very strict policy about music.
It's true.
but definitely, I think some people did fully fall asleep.
Although I will say,
speaking of being fatigued,
there was a touch of what we like before the music, some talking.
There was a little talking.
In that talking, there was reference to an interview with Eliane Radig.
Yeah.
And her definition of music, I think we might fit in.
Which is?
Music should be as vast as space.
Well, that is everything. That's all of it, folks.
Except time.
That's all she wrote. And it's a big week, you know, just in events.
There was some, apparently some quite hideous talking.
By our city electeds.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of whom has resigned. I was busy in a new music concert. I didn't follow up with Kevin DeLeon.
I saw a tweet before we went in that said two down, two to go.
Oh, okay. So I wonder which one resigned.
I don't...
KDL or Gil Cedillo?
It was KDL, I think.
I mean, Cedillo lost his election, so he's leaving eventually one way or another.
It's true.
Whether he sits out the last couple months or not, you know, the people have already had their say.
Mm-hmm.
They already decided they didn't want him to continue. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying he should stay. I'm just saying everyone else has more to lose, I guess, than he does.
It's true.
He's already effectively lost. So there's that. Well, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, wait, hold on. The union guy already left. So if it's just Nuri and the union guy.
Oh, perhaps that was what the two down meant.
Oh, damn. You'd think it would be amazing. You'd think after, like, the president tells you to resign.
Yeah.
Because Joseph Robinette Biden did weigh in and said that they should
cut. I think it. I saw all of them at the Marciano collection.
I think all of them.
I'm sure they were there for the concert. They were just hanging out.
Yeah. As enemies of the people, they are definitely friends of the Marciano brothers.
Yeah. Foul mouthed city council members, the Dukes of Denim. They spend all their time, you know,
staring into the world's dumbest Anish Kapoor.
Right.
Yeah. Jesus Christ.
I think they had that Anish Kapoor. They kind of had made themselves. Just put the name up there.
Oh, right. Yeah, like they just got a guy to do it. Yeah. They were just like, something like this.
Yeah, you know, it's like conical and like put a bunch of mirrors in there. And then he interpreted it as faceted mirrors. And they're like, ooh, that's not really the visual effect we're going for. But
it's funny, yeah, when someone does the very... let's assume it is a real Anish Kapoor and not just a knockoff. You would then think that, like, well, I think everyone does this. Like, you do this one thing, and you're like, what if I make a variation that's different? And then you do, and then that's, like, the only time you do that. You know, like, there's the one time you do it differently, and you're like, yeah, no, we're not doing that.
Maybe it was an entirely thoughtful commission on his part, and he was like, you know, I normally make what I would describe as perceptual psychedelic experiences, and I want to make, like, a cocaine version
for some dummies
of my work. So shattered mirror, you know, common surface on which cocaine travels.
Oh, well, yeah, but you don't do it on shards.
They were big enough for a line,
I think. That's true. Yeah. Or for casual bump. Yeah.
I could imagine like some Marcianos suspended, like Mission Impossible style. down to do a few dozen lines off of the Anish Kapoor.
Yeah. Well, you're probably not wrong.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, city council, Marciano, the Angela Lansbury died.
Oh, I'm sure that sent shockwaves to your household, Steve.
We are in deep mourning.
Steve's wearing all black for the first time I've ever seen.
It's a color I never wear, except in these kinds of extreme moments. We have before and into the pandemic, we watched all of Murder, She Wrote, and. While I would say that the later seasons definitely are not as good as the earlier seasons, I think all of them are pretty charming. They introduce some comic relief characters, like her nephew Brady, who is like a definite drag on the series. But and there's a fun crossover with Magnum P.I. The first five seasons of Murder, She Wrote, just go out and watch them, folks. It's unbelievably pleasurable.
Yeah. This is the great thing about recorded media is that in a way she'll never die.
It's true. And her entire life is created within the boundaries of recorded media. She started at the beginning of the talkie. She was in an early star of talking cinema and then...
Yeah, she's in Gaslight.
You know what I mean? It's crazy. It's like, what a career. She was the star of stage as well and musicals. Yeah. She started in...
No, because the first time I watched Gaslight was maybe 3 or 4 years ago.
To catch up on what the word meant, because that was when the word started to become used all the time.
I can't remember what the impetus was, I saw her and she's, you know, must be 20-something.
I think at that point she's actually in her 30s.
Oh, okay. Well, she's much younger than the Angela Lansbury that I knew well.
Younger, yeah. Yeah.
And it was like a primordial itch. Like, I was just like, who is that?
I know who that is.
Who is that?
And you're just not used to seeing people through that length of a career.
No, because not
it's
at
like,
all.
Because even seeing her as a relatively... Because her being in Murder, She Wrote was also considered a landmark for older acting. Because, of course, with like the sort of... You know, another thing that happened this week is the second Weinstein trial started jury selection. So, you know, like there's this rampant sort of sexist meat grinder in Hollywood, right? And what happens to an actress when she gets older?
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, it's a well-known point of discussion in the acting community about like roles for older women and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. And she was... I think 60 or something like that when she started doing Murder, She Wrote. And it was sort of like, oh, look, the leading star of this super popular television show is, you know, a senior, like sure. a female senior citizen. You know, like people are willing to like invest in stories featuring older actresses, not just older actors.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because like people don't realize this, but like, you know, Paul Newman served in World War II.
Yeah.
Like he was a leading man when he was very old. But somehow that's not the case with, you know, so it was seen as trailblazing. But then, you know, Murder, She Wrote is a part of my childhood. I'm a middle-aged man now, and Murder, She Wrote was on when I was a boy.
It's true. I watched it with my grandmother.
You know, so it's one of those things where that career just keeps getting longer and longer. And she was the teapot in Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, right.
Wild. It was a pretty loving, continuous tribute to her throughout this morning's Democracy Now! If anyone wants to hear Amy Goodman keep talking about Angela Lansbury, because apparently she was harbored extremely leftist political views, despite, as Jessica Fletcher, helping the cops nonstop.
Yeah, her faith in justice.
Jessica Fletcher is a role. It's not who Angela Lansbury is by any means. Apparently, Angela Lansbury was much farther to the left than Jessica Fletcher.
Okay. Well, speaking of the horrible meat grinder that is Hollywood, we've invited a very special guest on tonight who's has a lot to say on this particular subject.
Indeed.
Indeed. So without any further ado, we'd like to welcome Colleen Smith.
I want to begin with Mr. Vogel's words. Subversion in cinema starts when the theater darkens and the screen lights up. For cinema is a place of magic where psychological and environmental factors combine to create an openness to wonder and suggestion and unlocking of the unconscious. It is a shrine at which modern rituals rooted in atavistic memories and subconscious desires are acted out in darkness and seclusion from the outer world. The power of the image, our fear of it, the thrill that pulls us toward it is real. I first read those words 35 years ago. And when the first folks at New York Film Festival invited me to do this talk, of course, the first thing I did was head to my bookshelf to find my copy of Vogel's book, and I couldn't find it. I probably loaned it to someone a long, long time ago, and I'm not sure when I last sat down to read it in its entirety, but I did read it all of last week. And I realized then that as a young filmmaker, I had internalized much of this book. And I, so much so that I had failed to distinguish which of my codes for filmmaking were my own and which I had gleaned from Film as Subversion. And then today at lunch, I was recalling that there were entire chapters, once heavily focusing on like European and Soviet cinema, that I pretty much ignored as a young student, feeling that the writer was in fact ignoring me. And while I do wonder about what may or may not have had the opportunity to grace the screens at Cinema 16, I do not doubt that Mr. Vogel was speaking to what he was seeing and anticipating things yet to come. And I'd like to think of myself and others like me as part of that yet to come. As a teacher, I'm making a note of this to remind myself and my students of this chasm between like a foreign context of a written text and the way that it can feel like reciprocating this experience of invisibility one might feel seems justified, you know, like the book is ignoring me, so I'm going to ignore the book. But really trying to meet the text where it is and when it was has a real fruits and real treasures. And that's kind of what I experienced last week when I just dug into it. I'm going to play the part of this film, and I'm really excited about talking to Jackie. So all these clips that I am including, I'm going to cut them short, and I apologize because I just want to get to the part where we're all talking. So I'm going to read while this film, which is silent, is playing. Mr. Vogel's words also reminded me, and I'm so grateful for this reminder, that my investment in the moving image has something to do with what happens when moving images are being recorded, what happens between us, the makers of movies, and the world. For me, filming on location is an opportunity for social participation as opposed to the typical film methodologies that enact conquest and extraction. And when I learned that film was a language all those 35 years ago, I very naively decided that maybe the vocabulary could be expanded or altered and that the formal registries of film could change and therefore one's experience of cinema could change too. You see, back when Mr. Vogel was watching films and recording his thoughts and running Cinema 16, I was just a kid in Sacramento whose primary babysitter was the television. And most of what I watched very, very actively assaulted and diminished me and everybody that I loved. So when I learned that it wasn't media that was doing the assaulting, but people who made it, I thought maybe I could make something that I had never seen before. Maybe I could make a moving images that would not assault or diminish me or anyone else. This is just a studio shot. And I'm really excited that I can actually see my notes. I was afraid that I couldn't, but there's gonna be a moment where I'm lost. So bear with me while I pull out my notes. Mr. Vogel also says that subversive cinema could not exist without enemies. I love that. Any pessimism regarding the failure of one talent or the co-option of another is outweighed by the spectacular flow of new generational talent and fresh, hot anger. That is a quote. I was an angry young person, and I'm an angry old person. back when Mr. Vogel's predictions felt like an invitation to me, an invitation that I received and I gratefully accepted. The image here is what's happening in my studio right now. I'm making some procession banners that are going to be used as props in a film, which is typically my way of, or reason even, to make a film. The messages on these banners vary, but cumulatively, they amount to a celebration of refusal and resistance, a resistance against wanton extraction, willful ignorance, and grotesque abuse of this planet in the quest for wealth and resources. I would not call myself subversive. I don't know why that's hard for me. But based on Vogel's definition, I think I really do kind of fit the bill. And it's a good thing, since I'm here talking about him with you. But I think about this idea of needing an antagonist. That's such a cinematic position to take. I've been experimenting for some time with making films, or a kind of filmmaking that attempts to use the tactics of improvisational music, music that's made in time together with other musicians. Methods of making moving images that make everyone present a part of what's possible, as opposed to objects manipulated in service of a single vision. Sometimes these experiments succeed, but they often fail. So there's a lot of films I've made that no one will ever see. And I'm often tempted to just even destroy the hard drives they're stored on, but I won't do that. This clip I'm sharing now is another procession that I was designing for film, and it went horribly wrong, which we can talk about later. But this clip, with all its glitches and hiccups, comes really close to succeeding in this idea of like all of us together making something. And since it also has banners, I thought I'd show it. I might end it early, though, so forgive me if I just cut it off.
Camera's rolling.
Interior take 1A.
You lead me to the cross.
it goes on to all the way down the street, but I'll stop there. Before playing this next clip, I want to say that October 20th will be Sun Ra's Day of Becoming. It's the day that he officially changed his name from Herman Blount to Sun Ra. And I that factoid like collided with my time reading Mr. Vogel's book, where he says, in the last analysis, every work of art, to the extent that it is original and breaks with the past instead of repeating it, is subversive. By using new form and content, it opposes the old, if only by implication, serves as an eternally dynamic force for change, and is in a permanent state of becoming. It is therefore the triumph, the irony, and the inevitable fate of the subversive creator as she succeeds immediately to supersede herself. For at the moment of victory, she is already dated. He's like, I just love his quote. They're so good. Art can never take the place of social action, and its effectiveness may indeed be seriously impaired by restrictions imposed by the power structure, but its task remains forever the same, to change consciousness. I'm just going to read that again. The task remains forever the same, to change consciousness. When this occurs, it is so momentous an achievement, even with a single human being, that it provides both justification and explanation of subversive art. And this reminds me that this is a person writing at a time when this kind of work had to be justified, that it didn't even have a place, like not even the art world, to exist comfortably, and that people like him had to make space for it. It's important to remember. Things change. This next clip is, it's really long, and I'm going to cut it too soon, but I just want to keep it moving.
Thank you.
They were like my primary collaborators in Chicago for about 4 years, and I still miss them. I like have dreams of them. Like, want to call the marching band director at the high school. Hey, want to do another one? When this talk began, I asked you to come sit in a cave with me, and all I've done is drag you through these streets. And I'm sorry about that. And I think the contradiction in the way I've structured the talk is has some kind of enactment of the tensions I feel surging through our world right now. What kind of response should we be having to the state of our country? More voting, more protesting, more TikTok, more tweets? I don't know. I feel exhausted by the way our political body just seems like a clown show. And I'm hopeful. And the only hopeful gestures I ever find really exist outside on the block, in the city, on the streets, with my neighbors, with my students, my friends, my colleagues. It's the things that we make together, the conversations that we share, that make up the society that I want to contribute to. So I guess I was inviting you into the cave so that we could restore ourselves and get ready to get back in those streets. And when we get tired, there will be restoration. There will be art for us. And we can subvert these murderous social orders just by being with each other and making stuff for each other and for everyone else. That is my hope. That was my hope, maybe with this talk. And so the final quote from Vogel is quite long. I have to read the whole thing because these words are more true now than when he wrote them. And this is terrifying. And since we'll have a chance to talk more directly about the work after this, I'd like to end with this. So here we go. The artist finds herself at odds with society's unplanned and cancerous growth and the service of the profit motive and its heedless disregard for human values. Wherever she turns, she sees exploitation and magnificent wealth, heart-rending poverty and colossal waste, the destruction of races and the growing international trend toward totalitarianism. She sees control of all communication by the few and the rise of new media that holds the technological potential of more repression. She sees the blighted cities, the polluted rivers and oceans, the unbridled exploitation of natural resources, the succession of economic crises, inflation, depressions, and the ever more destructive wars, and the rise as permanent and monstrous institutions of war economies and their intolerable burden upon society as a whole. She witnesses the phenomenon of manipulated democracy and an electorate whose voting power is increasingly denuded of meaning since real control rests elsewhere. Vogel takes us into Marx here, so let's go. It was Marx who, when asked in an interview to characterize the meaning of life in a single word, unhesitatingly replied, struggle. Was it a slip of the tongue that prevented him from limiting this definition to life under capitalism, thus giving it the historical dimension he gave every other phenomenon? Or was it not rather his realization, so often expressed in his philosophical writings, that the essence of life under all circumstances and all societies was eternal change, the constant transformation of all forms and systems? It is in this sense that the subject of this book, Film as a Subversive Art, will always remain on the agenda, and that these pages are but a rough draft, for the subject of this book is human freedom. At all times and under all conditions, its guardians are the subversives. Whew. I really, really love that. I'm so grateful that I got to read it and read it to you.
Wow. That was our tribute to Eliane.
Yeah.
That was a remarkably optimistic. Normally, I think just the sheer brutality of existence leads most of our guests to, when they're being in earnest, you know, assessing the situation, to relatively pessimistic conclusions. It's nice to have such a optimistic appraisal of the potential of doing a creative thing.
Yeah. No, it was not where I saw that going.
You know, yeah.
When she begins with her frustrations about, you know, basically being ignored from these histories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
And her response being that people who feel ignored should ignore those histories, which we can maybe get into later.
But then she changes her mind.
She changes her mind. Yeah, we should meet these things on their own terms. And obviously they're all going to have foibles in hindsight. Some worse than others, of course. Obviously, Amos Vogel did seem like he was trying his best.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nazi propagandists, I wouldn't, you know, that's a different subject, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also a different time.
So what do you think about this proposition of Colleen's that you could try to make cinema without dominating anyone?
I think, first of all, I think there's a problem with the camera, right?
Right?
Like, you have to point the camera at something. And I'm not going to make an argument here for, you know, virtual reality or some other bullshit. But what I'm saying is just that, like, you know, there's something that's in the frame, there's something that's outside of the frame. And in real life, those things are all in interaction with each other. And in cinema, you inevitably point a camera at something and block out all this other stuff and include just this stuff that's in front of the camera. It's within the range of the lens. And so by sort of excising things from reality and separating them from the continuity of space around one, you know, the camera inevitably has this dominating feature. But I think there's also, like, you know, we have this experience. I don't think that necessarily invalidates sort of another general point about Colleen's argument about making cinema without domination, because, like, we live in Los Angeles, and other than the Dodgers,
which is kind of a camera event in itself.
No kidding. but outside of the Dodgers, we have a situation where, you know, we all live through these sort of dominating cinematic events, right? Like, oh, if you're in a press for time and you want to get over here or do this thing, and then you can't because that entire neighborhood's blocked off for filming, right?
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes there's a little bit of a kind of frisson because you think, oh, I'm going to see one of these movie stars.
Yeah, it's the new Ghostbusters movie. Yeah. Or like you can't go over there because they're making Tenet, yeah, you know, and you can't go through downtown.
But more often than not, this is the really shitty thing about living in Los Angeles. I mean, there are other things, but this thing kind of sucks. It's like, okay, so then you're trying to go to your studio, you park six blocks away because they're shooting Tenet 2, and you're excited. Maybe you'll see, you know, a great actor or something like that.
Robert Pattinson.
Yeah, Robert Pattinson, Michael B. Jordan. But then, you know, there's a security guard kind of like lazily smoking a cigarette, kind of half-heartedly guarding the set, and you ask him what's going on, and they're just shooting a fucking Pepsi commercial.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like they've added like citrus to Pepsi, and this is supposed to get everyone's panties in a bunch.
And it's just Pepsi.
Yeah.
It's always just Pepsi. I mean, and so I think there is a way to make movies without doing that, right?
Yeah, there are degrees, of course, right?
Yeah, where you are in the community and you are a friend of the people, and mm-hmm. people recognize you so that you can be in the community with a camera, and it's not separating people from their lives. You know, it's not making you park six blocks away. Like, you can walk through the frame. You're a community member as much as anyone else, kind of thing. You know, mm-hmm. like, you belong in the movie as much as anyone else.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, and you understand why the movie's getting made, because you're in the community where the movie's getting made. And you're like, oh, you know, like, it's that person doing their thing.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to being like, an alien landing squad has, like, separated me from my neighborhood, you know, and after 6 p.m., all the trucks will get loaded up and they'll all leave.
Yeah. Well, I'm not trying to poke any holes here or make an argument to be Christopher Nolan, but...
You better not.
But Colleen kind of provides an interesting counter-argument to her own stance when she brings up that Marx quote.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because she does sort of... Well,
I think that all of humanity is struggle, or I forget the exact quote, but basically the argument that she makes is that Marx doesn't distinguish that human struggle is essential to capitalism, but is perhaps essential to humanity itself.
Right. Yeah. And that's unusual, right? Because normally Marx makes the point of saying, like, this is the situation under capitalism.
This is sucking in this particular way because of this particular conditions.
Under capitalism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then
again,
you know, he starts out as a Hegelian philosopher, and I'm a little rusty on all that stuff, but the process of understanding the self as being seen by the other, a kind of violence. Uh-huh.
The thesis, antithesis,
kind of camera-like experience of you come into your you come into self-recognition through someone else, not through yourself. You know.
How do you think that Hegelian read of the fact of cameras plays into, like, you know, have you hung out with any children born lately?
like in the last few weeks.
I would say, like, anyone under the age of 5 or something like that.
Yes, but where? I mean, yeah. The short answer is yes.
So, I think about this because it's like I remember my relationship to cameras as a child, mm-hmm. being very, you know, like, you would drop the film off at the mall, and then pick the film up at the mall
a few weeks later or something,
or a couple days later, however it worked. You could pay more to get them faster, and at a certain point it was fast no matter what, I think near the end, but and you could go to Costco and it was cheaper, but you know, we have a situation now where it's like, you take a picture of a kid and the kid's like, hey, show me your phone.
Huh.
How do I look?
Hmm.
Right? Like the sort of the sort of struggle over how one is perceived is entirely sort of imploding on itself in the sort of context of the sort of like Hegelian argument around photography that you sort of like sketched out earlier, right? Where it's like the child is photographed and expects and understands truthfully that, like, I can see the picture. Mm-hmm. I can see what you think, how you made me look.
Mm-hmm.
I can see what you think of me right now.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, like, I'll never see what you think of me. You know, when, like, Diane Arbus is out there taking pictures of, you know, the weirdos of America, right? They aren't immediately shown how she made the picture look.
Yeah, if they ever see it at all.
Yeah, right? Like those, you know, Walker Evans, you know, all of these, like, sort of touchstones of the photography of sort of this ethnographic photographic moment are all sort of separated from that sort of moment of, well, this is what Walker Evans thinks of people in the Dust Bowl, and this is what people in the Dust Bowl
mm-hmm.
are, whom I only know through, you know, Steinbeck novels and Walker Evans photos or whatever. But you know what I'm saying, right? Like, those people had their own lives and were their own people as well, right? So yeah, what do you think of that? What in this moment now, where the sort of like production, like the sort of the two sort of Hegelian, you know, being watched and being the observed and being the observer, forming the self from the conflict with the other, and then there being in photography, that role is concretized in the form of the camera, right? Because someone has to point it at someone, and someone has to be on the other side of it.
Mm-hmm.
But then the space and time whereby, like, Diane Arbus and American, the wonder that is the broader American public kind of thing, are like sandwiched together immediately. How do you feel like that's affecting the selves? How do you see this playing out, Nicholas?
I mean...
From a Hegelian perspective.
I don't claim to be a Hegelian philosopher.
Yeah, you did more in school.
I dipped my toe in, but I would say that, forming oneself in relationship to an image rather than to another person, that would be a later Hegelian philosopher named Jack Lacan and his great writing on the mirror stage. And I would encourage our listeners to have a gander at that.
They've already read that.
Also, if you're interested in...
our listeners went to CalArts.
If you're interested in topics of image, formation of self, technology, and the camera, I invite you to an event tomorrow night at 220 Arts, the effects release launch of issue number 3, entitled Mimicries.
So smooth. That was such a smooth transition to the plug, folks. I am astonished. That was brilliant. Wow. Wow, Nick, thank you.
Tomorrow evening, 7:30, 220 Arts. Be there or be square.
Also, be there and be square.
Be there and be square.
You're square both ways.
Yeah.
One way you go to an event.
Yeah.
And the other way, you stay home.
Yeah.
Or do something else.
Be there, be square. They'll also be selling copies through a Square reader, I imagine.
Whoa.
Yeah.
How much are copies?
How much do they cost?
Yeah.
I don't know. As a contributor, I didn't have to pay.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, good night, Chinatown.
Good morning, Chinatown.